Imagine walking into a workplace where your name, hair, accent, or cultural background never become barriers to your success, where systems are designed with you in mind, not as an afterthought. This is the powerful vision behind Decentering Whiteness in the Workplace. Published amid America's racial reckoning following George Floyd's murder, this groundbreaking work challenges us to examine how whiteness, not as a skin color, but as a power structure, shapes our professional environments in ways both obvious and invisible. What makes this approach revolutionary is how it shifts the conversation from simply adding diversity to fundamentally reimagining workplace systems that have privileged white experiences as the unquestioned default for generations. Whiteness isn't biological. It's a carefully constructed social category created to establish and maintain power. When Africans first arrived in Virginia in 1619, there were no white people there. The concept emerged decades later as a way to organize society hierarchically. Throughout American history, the definition of whiteness has expanded strategically to maintain power. Irish, Italian, and Jewish Americans all transitioned from being racially marginalized to being considered white. This historical foundation explains why today's workplaces center whiteness by default. The systems weren't designed with everyone in mind. They were built around white cultural norms, communication styles, and definitions of professionalism. This centering happens not through individual malice, but through structures that automatically advantage those who fit within white cultural frameworks. Workplace systems, the practices, procedures, and processes implemented to carry out organizational tasks, are primary drivers of persistent inequity. Performance evaluations frequently center whiteness through narrow productivity metrics and subjective assessments. Consider how customer satisfaction metrics disadvantage employees of color when white customers show racial bias, or how student evaluations in academia, despite research showing inherent racial bias, remain the primary assessment tool for professors. Hiring practices often center whiteness through coded job requirements like native English speakers or top university degrees that disadvantage non-white applicants. Limited posting channels and over-reliance on platforms like LinkedIn typically yield predominantly white candidate pools. Automated systems compound these issues. Applicant tracking software filters out candidates with employment gaps or non-traditional education paths, disproportionately affecting non-white applicants. Studies show resumes with Black-sounding or Arab-sounding names receive fewer callbacks across industries and countries. Referral hiring further perpetuates racial homogeneity, as employees typically recommend people from similar backgrounds. Organizations must either eliminate referrals or restructure programs to target underrepresented candidates without tokenization. Advancement processes reflect similar biases through unclear promotion paths and stereotyping. Black employees face a broken rung, blocking progression to management, while Asian employees encounter a bamboo ceiling due to leadership stereotypes, systemic barriers that emerge from defaulting to white workplace norms. Workplace policies often center whiteness in ways that disadvantage others. Appearance standards frequently deem Black hairstyles unprofessional or require shaving despite medical conditions more common among Black men. Family policies typically reflect white Western norms, covering only nuclear family members while excluding extended family relationships that are central to many cultures. Health insurance policies similarly privilege the white nuclear family model, allowing only current spouses and children as dependents. Work arrangement policies continue this pattern. Corporate leaders push for office returns despite 97% of Black workers preferring remote work, where they experience fewer microaggressions. Customer service practices also default to white preferences, with many non-white business owners masking their identity to appeal to white audiences, reinforcing whiteness as the consumer standard. White voices in the workplace refer to viewpoints that reflect and uphold white-dominant cultural values and norms. This doesn't only mean white people speaking, it includes how non-white people amplify and venerate white perspectives to succeed. we're often mindful of an invisible white audience that dictates our behavior, as Chris Rock noted when saying, "Don't fight in front of white people." This manifests in meetings where non-white employees report feeling invisible or having their contributions ignored, particularly East Asian employees and Black women. When non-white employees do contribute, their ideas are more likely to be overlooked or attributed to white colleagues later. Even when organizations bring in DEI consultants from marginalized backgrounds, their expert advice is sometimes disregarded in favor of what white leadership believes is best. Racial gaslighting occurs when someone from a marginalized background shares an experience with racism and has their experience questioned or invalidated. Tone policing happens when someone tries to control how information is shared rather than engaging with the content itself. Both practices center white comfort over addressing actual inequities. Ironically, the DEI and anti-oppression space centers whiteness in insidious ways. In the United States, 76% of chief diversity officers are white, with executive-level DEI positions overwhelmingly held by white or white-adjacent individuals. White-led DEI businesses receive disproportionate venture capital funding compared to those created by non-white people. DEI work often prioritizes white comfort, as when practitioners agree to avoid controversial topics like white privilege to secure clients. Even DEI practitioners themselves can center whiteness in their messaging by carefully choosing words to avoid angering white audiences. Organizations default to white-owned and white-led businesses when seeking external DEI consultants due to unconscious bias that leads workplaces to perceive non-white businesses as less than or lower quality. This paradox extends to employee resource groups designed as safe spaces for marginalized identities that often become infiltrated by allies, implying these groups need white validation to be legitimate. Similarly, mentorship programs for underrepresented employees often promote a white savior complex rather than addressing systemic barriers. Decentering whiteness follows three steps: awareness, acknowledgement, and action. Organizations must gather data about employee experiences, disaggregating results by race and ethnicity to understand specific challenges faced by different groups. Organizations must then acknowledge these challenges openly. While some issue formal apologies for past discrimination, like the Baltimore Sun's 2022 apology to Black Marylanders, acknowledgement alone is insufficient. Accountability remains the greatest challenge. Beyond implementing anti-racist workshops, organizations must track progress through employee feedback and incorporate equity metrics into management evaluations. Success should be measured through the experiences of marginalized employees. True transformation requires centering those most marginalized by current systems. As the Combahee River Collective observed, if Black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free. Creating workplaces that serve the most excluded ultimately serves everyone. This journey demands sustained commitment, not quick fixes. When organizations decenter whiteness, they create more equitable, innovative, and successful environments where people thrive because of their differences, not despite them.